The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Live from Northern California, it's Lifeline with Craig Roberts. He's the host of Northern California's longest-running conservative talk show. He's a man with a message, a conservative with compassion. He's Lifeline's own Craig Roberts.
And a hearty good afternoon to you. Welcome. It is Wednesday, isn't it? Yes, by my latest calculations. Wednesday, the 24th of April. Craig Roberts and your show like here. Welcome you to another edition of Lifeline. We are here as we are each Monday through Friday, addressing issues that impact your life, your world, and your Christian walk. And we're going to break down some of that as it relates to what's going on in the wide, wonderful world of news with a special guest, certainly a familiar voice to KFAX listeners. He is an educator, a constitutional lawyer. He is best-selling author Joe Murray. Joe, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Craig, good to be back. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good, and I just have to start by apologizing. I know it's kind of tragic to invite you in on a day like today when it's such a slow news day. I mean, nothing going on, particularly, and nothing of any interest to somebody like yourself, constitutional lawyer, would love to dive in a few things. So I thought, in lieu of having anything meaty to talk about in the news, we could finally get around to that greatest male vocalist of the 20th century debate. You know the one I'm talking about, between old Blue Eyes, Frank Sinatra, versus Tiger Tom Jones, although I suppose we have to show some respect here and refer to him as Sir Tom Jones, though I must say, just Sir to set Tiger. The record straight before we dive into our debate here, that while we have to show respect and acknowledge that Tom Jones is Sir Tom Jones, the one thing that he's never been, and that is chairman of the board.
And we cannot forget about the king, too. We have to make sure Elvis fits.
Indeed, so
we have a king, a sir, and a chairman. I think they all walk into a bar, right?
Yep, there you go. Yeah, they always do. The joke always starts with that. All right, let's dive down to cases, because all kidding aside, there is just an absolute plethora of things to talk about. And I guess one of the easiest places to start is the one that's getting a lot of headline news today, not only here in the San Francisco Bay Area, places like Stanford, Berkeley, certainly California, Berkeley, and then across the other side of the country, Columbia University today. House Speaker Mike Johnson actually showed up to engage in some conversation with the chancellor there and say, what is going on? We need to start addressing these issues related to protests on campuses. Today we learned that the students that are protesting here in Berkeley are vowing that they're setting up camp and they are not moving until the university meets their demands. Now it runs the gamut of divestiture from investing in stock holdings that have anything to do with Israel, etc., etc. And while I know there are a lot of us whose hearts break for the tragic loss of life on both sides related to the current situation in the Middle East, the fact of the matter remains that the match was lit by Hamas. And I have to wonder, from your perspective, you know, it's great to encourage young people to get involved in the body politic and make a difference, but I've never quite understood the connection between shutting down the Golden Gate Bridge and delivering a message to Benjamin Netanyahu to stop the military engagement in the Middle East. I mean, what am I missing here?
No, this whole new thing of disrupting everyday life, this isn't a protest. This is an act of, you know, it's so overused, but it is an act of domestic terrorism. When you stand on the Golden Gate Bridge and disrupt commerce to that extent, or anywhere in the country where this has taken place, where people are no longer able to get to and from work, where goods are not able to get to where they need to go, that is an assault on one of our key infrastructure systems. That is not a protest. I remember when I was working with the American Family Association, the police would come down if a pro-life, even if it was just five pro-life protesters, if they showed up and started marching on the street without a permit, they were thrown in jail. That were so many of my cases. You know, you'd have about maybe six or seven, maybe if we're going to get really big, 20 pro-life protesters. They'd show up, they wouldn't have a permit, or you'd have a street preacher who was just standing on the sidewalk quoting scripture, and they would be doing this thing, and they would be hauled off and go to jail. And yet we see all these protesters, whether it's the BLM protesters or it is the Hamas protesters, they are coming out on the streets, they are disrupting, and the police are standing there impotent. I don't know what has happened, Craig. When did we get so scared of this radical left that we're not even willing to enforce the law? We're not asking people to go out and shut down and censor speech. You know, good Lord, if the police were manhandling them like they did the pro-life protesters that I represented 20 years ago, I would go represent them, because like Voltaire, you know, I might disagree with what you say, but I will defend to the death your right to say it. But they will not even follow the rules, Craig. And that's the thing. You go to Columbia, what's going on right now. These are not just protests. They are targeting Jewish students. They are manhandling Jewish students. And, you know, I laugh. When I was in law school, it was a few years before I actually got to law school, there was a case out in University of Pennsylvania. You may or may not remember it. It made headlines all over because some frat guy yelled out the window, "Water buffalo," to an African-American female. And it ended up getting him expelled. It was all this big thing. It was like, how dare you? You created an unsafe environment for this person. They no longer feel safe. How can they learn? And, you know, it was a little bit of an overreaction then. But you look at how what Columbia and these universities are expecting our Jewish students to deal with, and they're doing nothing. They're doing nothing. And I don't understand this, Craig, because, look, I, for the longest time, had issue with some of Israel's foreign policies. I was a Buchananite. I worked with Pat, and we had issue with some of the aggressiveness of Netanyahu. Actually, it was him back in the day, too, when we were dealing with this stuff. But October 7th changed it. You said it so articulately. It kind of turned the switch. And now Israel is dealing with a fight for its own existence. That would have been like Israel coming to us after 9/11 and telling us to stand down. It's just insane that we're having these conversations right now. And it's insane that the President of the United States, he can talk about polls, he can talk about giving Donald Trump a right hand, and he can talk about that stuff, but he can't get out there and give support to our Jewish students who are now living in fear and having to go to virtual classes.
Well, this is the tragedy, because at the end of the day, this has suddenly become a race issue, to the degree to which it is a religious issue, to be sure. And listen, I know that there are strong feelings on both sides. I know, and you and I have talked about this in the past, I do not thoroughly agree with every policy that the Knesset passes, or Benjamin Netanyahu, longtime listeners know to this program. We've had him on this program multiple times. I would say probably a half a dozen times easily that he has been a guest on this program. And I've said to him, you know, some of the occupancy in terms of what was going on in the West Bank and what have you, I always felt was just, you know, stoking the flames. Certainly here, part of the intent is looking at the history of the attacks on Israel, and they are voluminous, that the notion of if you hit us, if you slap us, we're going to hit back with a baseball bat, because mm-hmm. they do this to send a message to other neighboring enemies that would suggest, oh, if there's a tepid response by Israel, that's taken as open season. And let's be clear about it. There's never been an official Israeli policy to wipe out any of its neighbors. However, without exception, every one of its neighbors has had at one time or another, or even to date, an official policy to wipe out Israel. What I think is problematic here is, while I love the exercise in freedom of speech, I think it is so largely misdirected. And maybe you can speak to this, Joe, because at the end of the day, we like to tell freedom of speech and somehow that sense that we can say what we want, where we want, when we want, whenever we want. But if you're engaging in this kind of quote unquote freedom of speech protests, and now you are, as you suggested in the case of the Golden Gate Bridge here recently, prohibiting Congress from being able to move, or worse yet, somebody who's stuck on the bridge in an ambulance and desperately needs to get to a hospital and cannot, or in the case of many of these university campuses, you're blocking students not only from being able to attend classes that they have a right to attend because they paid for them or their parents paid for them, but also creating an environment of hostility where many Jewish students just feel as if, my goodness, if I dare walk down, you know, campus at night, the likelihood is somebody's going to put a shank in my back. I mean, where is the limit between allowing young people to learn the value of being engaged politically and expressing their thoughts through exercising their First Amendment rights, and that fine line between that and beginning to now curtail my rights because you're in the middle of exercising yours? You know what I mean? Where is that fine line?
Well, and that's what I was alluding to, because there used to be, there was a mechanism. You couldn't just show up and have a massive rally. You know, it was well within, you know, we used to call it time, place, and manner restrictions. You know, that was the big thing back in the late 90s and the early 2000s, where there was a give and take between protesters and city governments, and city governments saying, look, you have to at least apply for a permit. You can't just show up and shut down a street because it's going to cause a disruption. So, yes, tell us you're going to have your protest, and therefore we can have enough police there. We can make sure that the traffic is going to be redirected. There was this whole give and take. And the issue at that point, Greg, what I was always defending and representing, usually the pro-life movement on, was they would deny it. And they would come up with some cockamamie excuse to deny the permit. And then you'd have to file suit and sue on that. But now these folks aren't even applying for permits. They're coming up, they're showing up at these places. And if you notice the tents, Greg, I mean, these aren't some shantytown tents. These are some nice tents that are setting up. So this has to be funded from someone or somewhere or some organization. It's well organized. It's happening in these universities across the country. And this is the kicker, Greg. You know, Columbia is not a public university. It is a private university. Technically, the First Amendment doesn't apply there. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's the same thing. I always used to laugh when, you know, even though I'm a Cardinals fan and I don't want to rub it in, even though you're going to be rubbing it in on me this year, and I have hope on the draft. But when people got upset about Colin Kaepernick and said, oh, he has a First Amendment right, he should be able to take a knee, this is horrible, this is against free speech. No. He's doing a job. He is working for a private organization where his purpose is to throw a football and get touchdowns. None of us can go into our private employer and protest on their dime. So that this is what we're seeing now. We're seeing a kind of a muddying of the issue of what speech is. What free speech says, as simply as this, is that the government cannot restrict what you say. It is not absolute. There are limitations. A, it has to be a state actor. And B, if your speech rises to a level where it is going to create a problem, a material problem with how the government runs, or maybe with your right to get from plan A to plan, or get to plan A to plan B, whatever it is, or point A to point B, you can't do it. It is not an indiscriminate license to disrupt everyone else. And we're not doing this anymore. And that's what I was just talking to a buddy of mine. I said, I would have loved to have had these rules when we were dealing with the pro-life movement back in the 2000s, because you had to jump through so many hurdles to get a permit to protest. Now you just show up and shut down streets.
Yeah, and you know, I understand in the case of, you know, wanting to divest, you know, investment dollars and things of that sort. But as you point out, many of these cases, these are private universities. They have every right to control the kind of behavior that takes place on their campus, on their private property. And moreover, and I said this back in the day when we went through the Rodney King riots, I said, you know, I understand the protesting and the rioting going on. The problem is it's misplaced. You're doing it to your own neighborhoods. Yeah. If you wanted to send a message, go to Beverly Hills, go to Simi Valley where the trial took place, and send a message there. You know, in this case here, if they said that there were protests out in front of the Israeli embassy, I said, okay, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But you're going to shut down the Golden Gate Bridge, inconvenience everybody. And for those of you maybe listening that are thinking that might be a good idea, just imagine the number of people that you add to your list of people that are now suddenly against you, where previously, where heretofore they might have been favorably disposed toward your position, simply because they say, hey, you're punishing me. I've got nothing to do with this. Well, we're raising awareness. Well, I think we're aware, and there's a lot of ways that you can effectively raise awareness without trampling upon the rights of other people in the process. All right, we're going to take a timeout. You think, well, he's finally gotten the big topic out of the way. Surely they're going to get to the Sinatra-Tom Jones debate. No, no, no. There's so much more to talk about from a constitutional standpoint, and we're going to let Joe Murray sink his teeth into a bit more of these goodies, including to ban TikTok or not to ban TikTok. All that and more straight ahead here on the Wednesday edition of Lifeline. Our special guest, constitutional lawyer, best-selling author and educator, Joe Murray, as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
And on this painfully slow news day, we're visiting today with best-selling author and lawyer and educator Joe Murray, talking about a lot of issues that kind of go really to where his heartbeat is in terms of the law, constitutional law, our constitutionally protected freedoms, and ways in which we oftentimes see them either violated or perhaps taken for granted, and in other extremes, used out of context. Toward that end, Joe, a big debate that's been going on, and it seems that it may be getting closer to potentially being reality, at least until the courts step in, and that is regarding TikTok. Now, I'll be first to tell you, some of these crazy TikTok challenges, like, you know, swallow a gallon of powdered, what's the word? I'm looking at cinnamon, and tell us how that works out, and some of these crazy things. Yeah, it's nonsense, and it's intellectual bubblegum in that regard. And I'll be honest with you, I spend no time on TikTok. I spend occasionally time on Facebook. Of what I've seen between the two, they can be equally as informative as they can be equally as ridiculous, if not dangerous. I think the notion of, oh, we've just woken up to the fact that TikTok might potentially be influencing us from the outside, and while I can see cause for concern there, what's the difference between some of the craziness to false information and manipulation outright that TikTok does against anything that Facebook or Instagram has done over the last 6-10 years?
No, I've always viewed TikTok as kind of the virtual form of the carny, right? You know,
right.
You pay a dollar to see the bearded lady, or Snake Boy, or whatever it is, and that's what I think so many people do. Except, TikTok allows you to become part of the carnival experience by doing these ridiculous things, and then putting it up there for everybody to see. And I think that's what 90% of what TikTok is. Now, I will tell you, I am not on TikTok. I very rarely see TikTok. But what I do see is not always anything that intrigues me. But from a constitutional standpoint, there's a lot at play here. So you have TikTok, which is a company. Okay. And then you also have the TikTok users. So when the government comes in and says either divest and make it an American company or we're banning you, you're looking at the rights that the company has, but also the rights that the users have. Okay, so is it okay to shut down an avenue of communication, even though it's given by a private entity, but it's the government shutting it down? The closest that we've had on this is a case in Montana, where the Montana state legislature tried to do this, and the judge looked at it, and he sided with TikTok. Because as we were saying in the last segment, Craig, your First Amendment rights and your constitutional rights, while they are fundamental, they are not absolute. There is a give and a take. That's the price of living in a free society. So when you deal with First Amendment law, there's levels of scrutinies that are applying. You have what's called a strict scrutiny, and that requires the government, it has to have a compelling interest, and that interest is going to be narrowly tailored in the least restrictive manner. So if the compelling interest is that TikTok is a Chinese company and they're trying to use disinformation to undermine our own national security, we would think that that would be a compelling interest. Then it goes to the next part, which is it narrowly tailored in the least restrictive manner? A full-fledged ban, we're going to toss you out, is not, but is requiring it to divest, something that the Montana law could not do, right? Montana can't require a foreign corporation to divest, but the Congress can. So that being narrowly tailored, that's going to be an issue answer for the court. But even if you apply it to what's called the intermediate scrutiny, that's the middle scrutiny, you have to show an important government interest, and it has to be substantially related to that same interest. The divesting is an interesting issue. I can see the courts going both ways on this. It's going to really determine what judge gets this case. But I think the overarching thing is what you bring up, is that this is going on all the time now. When you live in a virtual world where people get their news not from Walter Cronkite at 6:30 in the evening watching the, you know, the news, but they get it from X, they get it from Facebook, they get it from TikTok, they get it from Instagram, and it's basically citizen journalism now. Everyone's a journalist. You're going to have this. So to me, the issue is not let's shut it all down. It's let's train people how to think for themselves. And let's train people not to fall for stuff. Let's train people to maybe not view one source, maybe view multiple sources. I don't think the issue is we're going to censor everything that we deem misinformation. I think that becomes problematic from a constitutional standpoint.
Well, moreover, that becomes also a near impossibility, because then what do? Do you train individuals who are going to be the arbiters? Now, certainly private controlled platforms, I know, and it's back to what you were saying before, understanding what your constitutional rights are, that the injunction against the restriction of freedom of speech applies to government, not to private industries. Can your boss tell you you can't use that language or can't talk that way in the office? Absolutely he can. But I think what's problematic here, beyond the idea of, okay, who gets to be the final arbiter of what stays and what goes, there is a notion that, you know, number one, do we run afoul potentially of restriction of free trade, meaning we shut down TikTok, so now in turn China comes in and shuts something else down. I recall a lot of the wailing and gnashing of teeth, and I will admit I did some of the same during the so-called Arab Spring. This is when we were hoping that there might be a serious revolt, a revolution in Iran, and that folks might be able to enjoy some freedom there. What happened? Tehran stepped in and they shut down the number one means that citizen journalism, the number one means of communicating in the country of citizen and with citizen, and that is Facebook. They shut it down. What do? We screamed and yelled, you're restricting, you're trampling upon their rights to communicate, so on and so forth. I find it a bit disingenuous that the same Congress that wants to shut this thing down yet for years allowed organizations like Russia Today to operate freely and pump all of the misinformation into the American body politic as they chose to. To this very day, Al Jazeera continues to have a presence. I'm on their website right now. Nobody's saying we're going to restrict you from watching that. So I'm curious, other than the fact that it's China and it's misinformation, what is substantially the difference between that and the misinformation that's coming out of just across the bay or down the street over here in Menlo Park from an outfit called Facebook?
The only, I guess, if I'm looking at this, if I'm playing devil's advocate and I'm saying, okay, what would be the strongest argument against TikTok? And I think if they go in on the misinformation, or they say we're trying to protect from election interference, they're going to lose on that, because the price of living in a free society is, yes, the people have the right to hear all the information, even the wrong information, and it's up to the people to decide what's true and what's not. Okay, that's the price of living in a free society. Where I think there might be some case, and I don't really hear a lot of people arguing this, is that if TikTok is deliberately targeting youth and they're targeting them to do dangerous activities and their algorithms are supporting that, getting these young kids, I'm not talking about 20-year-olds, I'm talking about, you know, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, 11-year-olds, with these TikTok challenges, which the youth listens to. Believe me, I've seen it firsthand. It's like, once this challenge comes out, this is what, it's kind of what motivates them. And if they are using their algorithms to get American youth to do dangerous things, then I think that is a valid reason to shut this place down, because you would not allow kids to go into a knife fight, right? You would not allow them to go into that type of establishment. We don't let kids go into a casino or buy liquor or buy cigarettes or go to these places that are off limits. And I think virtually we can make that same case. If they are targeting these kids, then I think you have a valid argument to come in and say shut it down. But I don't really hear that right now, which is why I think if you're really trying to shut down TikTok, you're going at it on the wrong angle. If it's because of misinformation, I'm sorry, you lose on First Amendment grounds.
Yeah, but I certainly concur with you when it comes to the dangerous acts, and there's plenty of it. I mean, you can Google TikTok challenge death and come up with umpteen number of tragic examples of young people that just being young people, and somebody said, I dare you, and that's all it took. And, you know, I joked earlier about the TikTok challenge to, you know, try to eat a tablespoonful of powdered cinnamon. By the way, never, ever do that. That's stupid, nasty, and could potentially be dangerous, especially if you inhale the stuff. But a lot of these kids don't know any different, and so they'll take on these challenges, and before you know it, they're doing crazy things. And I think certainly from the standpoint of protecting young people, there's an argument there, and perhaps some degree of policing needs to be done. I think the big problem here, Joe, maybe you could speak to this briefly before we go to the break, and that is whether we're talking about the stupidity and misinformation that becomes integral to the excitement called TikTok, or the same kind of stupidity and misinformation that shows up on Facebook, or quite frankly, on the front pages of even the New York Times on certain days, and almost every day in the National Enquirer. It seems to me that there's a degree to which, at this point, Joe, as regrettable as some of these influences may be, and I'll be the first to say, if I had to name one thing that's had the most horrific impact on society in the last decade or two, I would say, hands down, social media. That said, aren't we at the point where the genie is kind of out of the bottle? I mean, how are you going to stuff all this back in and go back to the days when we had, you know, reporters that were held to journalistic standards that had to tell the truth, and we didn't have, you know, your crazy Uncle Larry spouting off, you know, nonsense about chemtrails and things of that sort?
Well, you know, you make a great point. Social media is our crazy Uncle Larry. That is we've invited him into our home
every day, sometimes multiple times a day.
Exactly. And I think that's where the schools come in. That's where you need to teach people not only to become productive citizens, but also productive digital citizens. That, you know, just because it's on the screen in front of you doesn't mean that it's true. We used to have to do this. Remember, at the time when the country was founded during the revolutionary days, our newspapers were not objective. They were very much subjective. You had the Federalist Papers, you had the Anti-Federalist Papers, you had these were basically ways to convince and persuade people. The news was an art of persuasion back then. Now, along the evolution, we went from persuasion to informing, and we were there for quite some time. But, you know, starting in the 60s, as the baby boomers and the such came out, we started to see a little bit of a pendulum swing back to persuasion. And then, of course, with the Trump presidency, it became full-fledged persuasion. And that's what I laugh, because you look at it, the same people that are upset about misinformation from TikTok, you know, the Russia collusion stories, the Hunter Biden laptop. I'm not saying whether these are right or wrong. I'm just saying that these so-called journalists dropped the ball on these stories. They did not present them to the American people. So you are right. We cannot be the ones that be the arbiters of what is true and what's not. That is the ultimate job of the public in a democracy. What we do have to make sure is that people are not engaged in dangerous behavior. So when it comes to the content, yeah, that's up to the American people to decide.
Well,
but when it comes to the actions, that's when we have to step in.
And to the heart of your point, a name that is eminently well-known in the San Francisco Bay Area, William Randolph Hearst, considered to be the father of not modern journalism, but modern yellow journalism. It was he in the turn of the century, two centuries ago now, during the lead-up to the Spanish-American War. And there were concerns about a bunch of hullabaloo appearing in his newspapers that, quite frankly, was nonsense. And he wanted photographs. And at the end of the day, said, there's not a lot here to document. He said, you know what? You furnish the pictures and I'll provide the war. Meaning he would make stuff up because it was all about selling newspapers. And the tragic irony is that in more than a century, that hasn't changed, folks. It's just seen a shift of the platform. Instead of just one or two people like a DeYoung, like a Hearst, or others out there that were disseminating false information to sway opinion, move Americans to vote in a certain direction, or just to sell newspapers, today, guess what? It's all of the above, plus your aunt, your uncle, your crazy Uncle Larry, and even your kids, all contributory to the mess that we have. And the big tragedy, and Joe, you touched on this, is the utter lack of critical thinking skills that allows people to get pulled into these crazy traps of nonsense to the point of being dangerous because we have a severe absence of critical thinking. Speaking of critical thinking, when we come back, how many of you critically thought that once the SCOTUS handed down the decision vacating Roe versus Wade and Doe v. Bolton, that the issue related to abortion in America would be finally addressed and over with? Well, if you thought that, boy, have you got a surprise coming. Back with more with constitutional lawyer, best-selling author and educator Joe Murray as Lifeline continues.
And now back to Lifeline with Craig Roberts.
All right, welcome back to the conversation. We are visiting this afternoon here on the Wednesday, April 24th edition of Lifeline with constitutional lawyer, best-selling author, and educator Joe Murray. Joe, one of the significant high court decisions certainly of our lifetime was the vacating of the historic 1973 Roe versus Wade and Doe v. Bolton decisions, which for almost 50 years had legalized abortion without restriction, basically, across all 50 states. There was a hue and cry. It's got to be left up to the states, not a federal issue, that the basis of so-called right to privacy, upon which at least Roe v. Wade had been adjudicated, was basically a big error. And so both decisions vacated by the court. We thought that's it. Goes back to the local states. States will make their own decisions. Some people, I think, in the pro-life movement thought, well, this is a big victory for us. Now finally that's over with. We can move on and celebrate and pay attention to other things. Boy, were anybody that held that opinion wrong. Between what's going on in Arizona right now, what we've seen taking place in Ohio, I guess it is, right now even a case coming before the court yet once again in relationship to, well, the first time in fact they've heard something since vacating Roe versus Wade. What is your sense of all of this and where things are going? You've got extremes like Arizona that basically has an 1864 law now restricting abortion in the state, and then the contrast with a state like California that basically says come one, come all, no restrictions at all.
Well, you know, and I think the Arizona, and I don't mean this lightly because it's a very serious issue, but if we look at what is really fueling the Arizona case, it's that there was a law that was on the, you know, around the Civil War law, and it was left on there. And when Roe v. Wade came down, just the legislator just forgot to remove it because they weren't enforcing it because Roe v. Wade trumped it, and it just sat there. So now what we have is what we need is legislative housekeeping. So, you know, politics and policy were never meant to go fast. It's meant to be a slow, laboring process in order to prevent bad decisions from being made. So what the people in Arizona have to do now, and they tried to do it, but it didn't succeed before they went out on recess, is to call their lawmakers and tell them to repeal this law. And that's how the legislative process works. What's interesting coming out of Idaho, that's the case that's before the Supreme Court. This is an interesting case, and you're going to have these facts. So even when the Supreme Court says abortion is now a state issue, which I think is the correct interpretation, I don't think any of us ever thought that the penumbras included, at first, I don't think many of us even believed there were penumbras in the Constitution, but yet alone that the founding fathers were going to be contemplating abortion when they penned that document. So I think it's right that it goes back to the states. But now we have a policy from the Biden administration where they are going to try to use Medicare in order to turn every state hospital into an abortion clinic. So what happens is Idaho has a near total ban. And the issue is if a woman comes in and she's at a not a life threatening, but a near life threatening situation in Idaho, technically, the woman would not be allowed to have an abortion. And if she's not allowed to have the abortion, it could eventually risk her health. Or what happens is by the time she's ready to be at that life-threatening stage, it could impact her reproductive organs and ability to reproduce in the future. So what the Biden administration is saying, that these hospitals are taking Medicare money, so therefore, even though there's a near-total ban in Idaho, because they're taking Medicare money, they have to be able to perform abortions. And the states are saying, no, that's not true. You can't kind of sneak that in there, because let's be honest, some of the laws that are the policies the Biden administrations are using is like the old patient dumping. Remember back in our day, Craig, when you would have to go to a hospital, and if they didn't want to treat you, they would dump you off at the county hospital, right? They wouldn't treat you. They would ship you halfway across the city to a hospital, and you could have very well died or gotten hurt there. Well, you know, we passed laws to prevent that. And that's what the Biden administration is trying to do. It's also when they tried to do, remember they did this many moons ago when they were trying to deal with a national speed limit. You had places like Montana and South Dakota that wanted to have no speed limit. But the federal government came in and said, hey, if you take federal money for roads, you got to put a speed limit on. That's going to be an interesting point. I don't know where the courts are going to fall down on this, but the one thing that intrigued me, and I know I'm going long here, is but what Justice Alito said. In the actual patient dumping and type of Medicare laws, it actually refers to the unborn child. And it did that, Craig, because it wanted to make sure that if a pregnant woman landed on a hospital's doorstep, they would have to treat her and her child. So Justice Alito's point is this. How does that correlate with an abortion? If we recognize in this case that the unborn child needs to have medical treatment, how do you turn around and then kill it? So this is going to be something that is not going to be cleaned up very easily.
Well,
cases and so forth.
And precisely to your point, I think that a lot of pro-life people looked at the issue of the overturning of Roe, and I think there was a tremendous sense of concurrence that this is not a quote-unquote right that should be granted at the federal level. The same token, for all the talk about take it to the states, well, now you wind up with this hodgepodge, 50 states, 50 approaches, 50 opinions, and so while maybe we didn't want to see the right granted at the federal level, I think a lot of people, they would certainly say, well, would we prefer to be restricted at the federal level? So there's some degree of consistency. One of the big fears, of course, and California is a tragic example of this, where the state is essentially used for tourism now, because if you're in a neighboring state that has severe restrictions, you look at California, hey, come one, come all, you know, we'll put you up in a hotel room to boot. Come see the sights while you're here. I mean, it's sad, but those are the extremes that we're dealing with. In which case, while I know it sounds like, hey, it's really complicated and there's a lot of differing opinions, so let's let the states work it out, doesn't that end up creating the conundrum that we're in right now with this patchwork quilt? Where every time you turn around, the high court is going to find itself being called upon to try to adjudicate some debate.
Yeah, and it's going to be, as you say, it's going to be especially pertinent when it deals with the federal government and federal funds, because at the time the Constitution was written, the founding fathers never envisioned that the federal government would have so much money and so much, so many hands and so many cookie jars. So we now live in a world where the federal government is doling out millions, if not billions of dollars cash to the states. So now they have a certain legitimate right to say, if you're taking our cash, you got to play by our rules. It's what we did. Remember the Mexico City policy, when we would give foreign aid to different countries and say, well, you can take our foreign aid, but you cannot use it for abortions. And if you do, we're going to take that foreign aid back. So now it's kind of the reverse situation, where the federal government's going to say, well, we'll give you money for Medicare for your hospitals, but now you better perform abortions. So it's going to not be an easy cleanup. This case, I think, will give us a clear direction of where we're going. Are the courts going to come in and say, no, we're not going to allow this backdoor entry of abortion into the states? Or are they going to say, yeah, you take federal cash, you got to decide now, is your commitment to the pro-life cause worth it that you're going to give up your federal cash? It's going to be messy.
And clearly that's being used as a manipulative tool, in the sense that the federal dollars kind of has that carrot and stick aspect to it, doesn't it? In other words, you know, the carrot is, look at all this nice stack of money I have sitting here on the table. If you'd like to have access to it, well, you have to do it my way. And if not, my stick is going to be, you're not going to get access to the cash.
Hitting you on the head.
Yeah, hitting you on the head, exactly. And, you know, particularly for hospital providers, I mean, we all know the debate going on in healthcare. It's never going to be resolved, even though there was promises about once we get the Affordable Care Act passed, it will be the panacea for all that ails us. Today, we have controversy yet once again in California where, you know, we put restrictions on insurance carriers in both the automobile arena as well as casualty for homes. And now you're having more and more insurance carriers flee the state because it's starting to feel like Florida. There's too many disasters, too many fires, so we can't make money here. We're just going to choose not to do business in your state, which is already putting pressure on every single homeowner and building owner across the state. Now, added to that, you've got the issue of medical care, where they're saying, well, we're going to put caps on how much you can increase premiums every year. We want to set it to a baseline, you know, maybe 2%, 3% a year, and we all know how out of control inflation can be in the medical arena. And while that might be helpful for the folks that are paying the premiums, I have to wonder what's going to happen in terms of the downward pressure on both insurance carriers, not that I'm a fan of same, but on them and ultimately the hospitals. Again, we're back to carrot and stick, where you've got hospitals are going to say, of course we're going to start performing abortions. Maybe we're not in that business before, but if you're offering us all these federal dollars, hey, why not?
Yeah, and then you're going to have the issue of, will you have a doctor that's going to do it? Because technically now the doctor's in the position where if they perform the abortion, then a county prosecutor can then charge them with violating the law. So at that point, or the issue becomes, when is the mother's life actually in danger? When does that threshold cross? And then to make it all more confusing, every 4 years you might have a change in policy when you have a new occupant at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. So it democracy and this stuff was never meant to be easy. That's why we never got a lot of changes. But we're going to have to wade through some of these things. So, yeah, you've nailed it, Craig. If you are a pro-lifer and you think that that decision, the Dobbs decision, kind of made it the end game, that's just halftime.
Well, you're absolutely right.
Half to play.
And I think that we also need to be very cautious moving forward in terms of what politician is saying what. I mean, case in point, yeah. Carrie Lake of Arizona, who leading up to what was about to come down in Arizona said, oh, we already have a law on the books. The minute Roe is vacated, this is going to just kick in. Won't be anything to worry about. All going to be wonderful.
Yeah.
No sooner does that happen, and then somebody says, have you read the content of what's in that? Oh, well, you know what? Yeah, we need to change this. We need to work it out. Even Trump threw his hat in that ring and suggested that, you know, oh, we're just going to come together and we're going to fix it. We're going to fix it quickly. We're going to come up with a solution that's going to be amenable to all sides. Yeah, like that's ever going to happen on this planet. And now we've had Carrie Lakey go from I'm in favor of the 1864 law to I'm against the 1864 law to, well, we need to have these restrictions in place. She has flipped positions on this topic three times in exactly 2 years. Is there a cautionary tale here as well for pro-lifers that, you know, we've celebrated vacating the Roe and Doe decisions, and now a little bit of it's coming back to bite us because of, again, this hodgepodge. And what we're seeing, as you've pointed out so artfully, Joe, the federal government stepping in and trying to manipulate.
Yeah, and that's where we're going to be. What we're going to see is that when you go by state, abortion can be a winning issue. In my state of Tennessee, in Mississippi, the Deep South, even Alabama, I think many people thought crossed the line with the in vitro decision that it had. You're going to have pockets of pro-life strongholds, just as you have pro-choice strongholds, where you're going to have to watch, and you've hit the nail on the head, is that when it comes to national elections, abortion is not a winning argument. Now, I'm not talking principle here, so I don't want any of your listeners to think that I'm thinking that we should play politics with the right to life. I have been a firm believer of the right to life. That's why I got into the law. But I'm just coming at it from an analytical position. It's not going to win elections on a national scale. And I think the Republican Party is starting to realize that. So they have to very much walk a very fine line in trying to get the majority it needs to protect that right to life, right, in order to make sure that the hospitals aren't being blackmailed to do abortions. But they also have to do it in a way that doesn't alienate so many of those people, especially those independent voters in the national elections. So it's going to be something that we are going to probably figure out for the next 5 years.
Yeah, and toward that degree, then, I think it's important, too, for folks to be mindful, particularly so in states like Arizona and Iowa, yeah, but even in states like California. Don't think for a moment that abortion will not, quote unquote, be on the ballot.
Yeah,
it will be in one form or another. It will be. And that's going to be true not only at the state level. We saw this during the midterms a couple of years ago, but it's also going to be on the ballot, quote unquote, when we talk about the general election and what's taking place federally.
And look what they're doing in Florida, right? They have that initiative down there in Florida. And that's what you're going to see Democrats do on states that they want to be competitive. They're going to put abortion on the ballot, just like for Republicans. We're looking at immigration. We're looking at inflation. Now, I think as the data stands right now, those are the issues that are driving. We're not in 2 years ago in 2022 or 2020, right? We're not there. I think abortion, while it's important, everybody's kind of gotten used to the post-Roe world. And I think what's dominating right now is the images of illegal immigrants, the price of milk, the price of bread. That's dominating right now.
But let me ask you a question toward that end, Joe, and forgive the interruption here, but I see this a little bit more nuanced, perhaps more complicated, in that while typically there are sort of those polarizing national issues that drive everybody to the polls of the general election because you're going to either be in favor or against it, this year seems to be almost splintered in the sense that, for example, Republicans feel, conservative folks, pro-life folks feel, okay, we want a big victory with a change in the Supreme Court and vacating Roe and Doe. So the thing that's going to bring me out to the polls is, well, you mentioned it, what's going on with the border, what's happening with inflation. And yet for Democrats, they're going to see this in key states and going to say, you know what, we're going to use this as a wedge issue. And while it might not be good in drawing Republicans out to vote, this is going to be absolutely made for prime time for drawing out Democrat votes. Do you think there's going to be some of that taking place here where we're getting issues, but polar opposite, unrelated issues that are driving the two sides of the polls come November?
And here's going to be the key to that whole analysis and equation that you put, and that's going to be the independent, quote-unquote, soccer moms. They are the ones that tilt it to the Democrats because of abortion, because it hit home. I think where, if I'm reading the tea leaves, where it's going to change is a soccer mom in 2022 who was worried about abortion. If you're in Pennsylvania, a state that's probably not going to really limit the impact of abortion, or Michigan, or some of these places, you're thinking that abortion is safe right now, but are you safe? You see what's happening with the crime. You see what happens with immigration. You now see what's happening with your ability to put food on your table to feed the kids you have. I think where they go is where this election goes. And right now, I see them more concerned about with the issues that are happening now, not the what if. And abortion is a what if issue. What if this happens? I think inflation, crime, immigration is a what is. And I think that's what's going to be the fine line right now. And if inflation becomes a what if we get inflation by November, I think the Republicans need a lot to worry about. If they somehow manage to get the border under control, to get crime under control. I know it's a big ask, but we still have time. We know we have till November. If those things start to settle down, then I think it shifts back to the pendulum of the Democrats. Time will tell.
Final question for you. We're out of time, but I'm eager to get your input. How disappointed were you? How shocked were you in the announcement that George Santos is dropping and suspending his bid for Congress?
You could have knocked me over with a feather.
So somebody did the research and found out, well, so far there have been absolutely $0 contributed to his reelection campaign as an independent there in the 15th district in New York. So maybe that had a play in all of this decision, too.
His campaign was a TikTok challenge. That's
Joe, we sure love
run for office.
You got it. Joe, we sure love your insights, the humor that you bring, and obviously your experience not only as a man of faith and an ardent pro-lifer, but also your background in the law and education. There's Joe Murray, best-selling author, and Joe, as always, we appreciate your time.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.